You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
Way, way back in 2013, back when we had an adult president and not a tantrum-throwing, pussy-grabbing toddler-in-chief, I was asked at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney to share a dangerous idea of my own that would change the world for the better if implemented, and I responded like this.
Population control. There's too many goddamn people on the planet. And I don't know if that's a... You know, I'm pro-choice. I believe that women should have the right to control their bodies. Sometimes in my darker moments, I'm anti-choice. I think abortion should be mandatory for about 30 years. That's a dangerous idea. She wanted a dangerous idea.
That's held up as proof by religious conservatives that I am a genocidal maniac who wants to kill all the babies. Obviously, I wasn't being serious. I'm pro-choice, and I framed the thought of mandatory abortions for 30 years as something that comes to me in my darker moments when I despair of and for this world. Calling me a genocidal maniac for that comment is like calling a woman who in a moment of frustration said she wanted to kill her husband a murderer. She didn't really mean it, just as I really didn't mean it, just as Jonathan Swift didn't really mean sell Irish children for their meat. My point was this. There are too many people on the planet. There's not an environmental crisis that we face that can't be traced back to overpopulation. Deforestation, desertification, fossil fuel consumption, water shortages, polluted air, heating up the planet, the Great Pacific Garbage Pass, mass extinction. We talk about these things like they're concurrent but unrelated phenomena, each requiring a unique solution, but each shares the same root cause. There are too many of us. There are too many of us right now, and we're consuming too many of the Earth's resources right now, and we're poisoning the planet in the process right now. Earth has lost half its wildlife in the last 40 years. The wildlife we aren't crowding out, we're roasting out. The wildlife we aren't roasting or crowding out, we're poisoning. And that's with 7.6 billion of us on the planet today, and we're on track to top 11 billion by the end of the century. We're killing everything. We are living right now through and the cause of what's known as the sixth great mass extinction. And it's not just pandas and rhinos and elephants. A 2017 study in Germany found a 75% decline in total insect numbers in protected areas over the last 30 years. Imagine what the decline looks like in unprotected areas. The culprit? The pesticides we spray on crops, golf courses, and our ridiculous front lawns. Insects are at the bottom of every food chain. Kill all the bugs now, and we are three quarters of the way there, and you kill every living thing on the planet. So, what does all of this have to do with your sex and relationship podcast, Mr. Savage? Well, I'm glad you asked. The looming extinction of everything on the planet may not fit neatly into my wheelhouse, as they say, but spunk, cum, jizz, man chowder, baby batter, Pearl Jam, dong water, that does. And according to a terrifying new piece by Daniel Noah Halpern for GQ, headline Sperm Count Zero, sperm counts in the US, Europe, Australia, New Zealand have fallen by more than 50% over the last four decades, and trend lines continue to point down, down, down. Halpern writes, "We are producing half the sperm our grandfathers did. We are half as fertile. Sperm counts went from 99 million sperm per milliliter of semen in 1973 to 47 million per millimeter in 2011, and the decline has been accelerating. Would 40 more years or fewer bring us all the way to zero?" Halpern asks. Looks that way. Halpern speaks with reproductive epidemiologists and spermatologists, which I didn't realize was an actual gig until I read Halpern's piece. I went into the wrong line of work. And all signs point to our grandchildren being half as fertile as we are today. And there are only so many times we can have that number before men are infertile, which means we could soon face a worldwide infertility crisis along the lines of the fictional ones portrayed in Children of Men and Handmaid's Tale. The culprit in this case? The case of all the sperm cells disappearing? Those same pollutants were jizzing all over our crops, golf courses, and lawns, the fossil fuels we consume, the industrial chemicals we spew into the air and pack into consumer products. Many of these chemicals are what's called endocrine disruptors, chemicals that affect hormones. a man with endocrine disruptors in his system, and they are in everything and consequently everyone, produces less sperm and has lower testosterone levels. If the exposure happens in utero, and it does for all of us now, that man is likely to be born with a shorter penis and smaller testes. You'd think the straight men who run the world would be concerned about this. It's not just lower sperm counts, guys. It's also smaller dicks. Somehow we couldn't see this, well, coming. All the shit we're pumping into the air and water, all the chemicals and pesticides and pollutants that are killing off all the other living things on the planet, they're also making dicks smaller, balls littler, and sperm counts crater. The World Health Organization estimates that 9 million die every year as a direct result of air and water pollution. And just over the horizon, a potential fertility crisis that could lead, according to Halpern and the hair on fire experts he speaks with, to the human race becoming just another species that the human race drove to extinction. Not so good for us, probably, though, in the best interest of the planet. The piece is Sperm Count Zero. It is terrifying reading. Daniel Noah Halpern at GQ. Go read it. And in other news, Brett Kavanaugh is a disgusting piece of rapey perjury shit, and he doesn't belong on the Supreme Court. Coming up on today's show, on the micro edition of Savage Lovecast, the for free edition of the Savage Lovecast, tons of your cues, lots of my A, and on the Magnum subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast that you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com, twice as long and no ads, JP Bramer from Hola Papi at Them joins us for a second opinion segment. All that coming up on today's show. Today's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers all fresh, high-quality ingredients and recipes you need to create delicious home-cooked meals. Get your first three meals for free by going to blueapron.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers, available through a mobile app. New members get 30% off an annual membership. Visit aptiv.com/savage. That's aaptiv.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Bull and Branch, luxury, affordable, fair trade certified sheets. Get $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping by going to bullandbranch.com and entering Savage.
Hi, Dan, Nancy, and the tech savvy at risk youth. I'm a 20, heteroflexible, single female. So once every 2 or 3 weeks, I log onto a random chat site and I masturbate with people through my webcam. I never show my face and I feel perfectly comfortable doing this. Now, I am pretty submissive, so I love having people order me around and feeling sort of like somebody's toy. Recently, though, I have been using the tag daddy to match with people. I'm really into fulfilling sort of older men's fantasies. Now, here is my issue. I disclose my age to these men, which is 20 years old, and sometimes they will ask me if I'm younger, and I will occasionally, play along and say yes. This may lead to dirty talk where they call me a little girl, call me their princess. If I've shaved, they'll comment on that, and they'll say things like, oh, I'm going to come into your room when mommy's not home. So in my mind, we are totally playing out a fantasy. But I do have concerns over whether I'm tapping into really harmful or dangerous desires that these men have. And I can't be sure, because they're strangers, if they are compartmentalizing as well as I am. So I should note that I have, a fully developed body. I have breasts. I have curves. So nobody's sort of fooling themselves into thinking that I'm prepubescent or anything like that. Basically, I'm wondering whether I should be avoiding this type of role play altogether on the internet, or whether I should be changing the way I interact with these men so that I clearly delineate fantasy from reality. Essentially, am I providing an outlet for these men while having, sexy, fun time for myself? Or am I actually enabling and emboldening what I'm afraid might be a pedophilic behavior?
In his book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are, Seth Stevens Davidowitz, who we had on the podcast to talk about the book and his findings, Seth rolled out some uncomfortable data for us that he wrote about in the book that he found analyzing what Google now knows about our darkest secrets. A shocking number of people visiting mainstream porn sites are looking for portrayals of incest, Seth writes. 16 of the top 100 searches for men are looking for incest-themed videos. The numbers for women around incest searches lower, but still 9 out of every 100 searches by women looking at porn online, looking for incest porn. So this is a relatively common fantasy. It is taboo. It is transgressive. Nobody who doesn't share it wants to hear about it or really think about it much. I have siblings. I have parents. Every time I've had to discuss calmly and professionally incest theme anything with anyone, it just, you know, gives me deeply squicky feelings. You're having some of those deeply squicky feelings. At least you are after you come. You get online, you put the hashtag daddy up, knowing it's going to attract guys who have this particular interest. You are not a child and you don't present or appear to be an adolescent. So when you tell them you're 20 and you're busty and curvy, and they ask you if you're younger, in a sense, they're asking you to play along, to spin out this fantasy scenario that they have about doing something really fucked up, really transgressive. There is no research out there showing that people who indulge in their taboo, transgressive to the point where they can never actually be acted on fantasies, are likelier to act on them IRL, as the kids used to say on the internet, in real life. So again, no evidence that what you're doing, indulging these men and yourself, please take some personal responsibility for getting off on this too, indulging these men and yourself in this kind of fantasy role play is not necessarily, we have no evidence that it's endangering actual children. It is super squicky. No one who doesn't have this fantasy wants to hear about it. And not everyone who has this fantasy wants to act on it. When you talk to people who have incest fantasies, and I have talked to many over the last nearly 30 years, they fantasize about incest sort of as an abstraction. They're not fantasizing about their actual siblings or their actual parents or aunts or uncles or nieces or nephews or cousins. They're fantasizing about this scenario and projecting themselves into it and casting, in a sense, strangers. And it's this casting of strangers that allows them to tap into the abstract incest fantasy. Here's a little something for everyone to Google this morning if you're bored. The Westermarck effect. Edvard Westermarck wrote a book, The History of Human Marriage, came out in 1891, and his theory was that people raised in, quote, close domestic proximity during the first few years of their lives become desensitized to sexual attraction, thank you, Wikipedia, that you're not attracted to your siblings because of any sort of genetic hardwiring, but because of the closeness and intimacy of being near each other during your formative years, growing up, same thing with parents, raising their children, that just this Westermarck effect intervenes to shut down sexual attraction. And there have been cases where people who are siblings were raised apart, adopted out, and met later in life, and were sexually attracted to each other, had sex with each other, which led to the theory of genetic sexual attraction being a thing. And now people who go off in search of their birth families, adopted adult children, are often warned by social workers to be wary of genetic sexual attraction. Anyway, long tangent, getting back to you and your question, is this okay? No. But how can I stop you? How can anyone stop you? And my no is entirely grounded in just squickiness with the concept of incest. You're not harming anyone. You're creating more joy and pleasure in the world. You're not upping the chances that any of these men are going to act on these fantasies. You have these fantasies and you have no desire to act on them in real life. And I think it would be fair to assume the cases of most of the men that you're indulging online in this fantasy role play, that they too have no interest in acting on it in real life. All that said, if I were you, if I were in your shoes and I was online and someone said, when I told them I was 20, it's been a long time since I could tell anyone that I was 20, so I can fantasize about that for a second. And they asked me if I was really 20 or I was younger, to step out of the role play in that interaction and say to them explicitly, I'm actually 20, but happy to engage in a little age play role play if that's what turns you on, and then let them buy back in. So I would encourage you to do that, just to have this moment where you check in with that other person and you just put out there that acting on this fantasy in reality would be wrong. Fantasizing about it with another consenting adult, not wrong. Just like two consenting adults can engage in ravishment or rape fantasy play or master-slave play, not okay for human beings to own each other. A lot of people get off in sex on pretending that that's what they're doing or that's what's being done to them, and that's fine so long as it remains a fantasy. So if you take that moment to tag that base and say, hey, willing to play along, this is wrong, right? We both get that this is wrong and nothing either of us would ever, could ever do in real life, then I think that I can give you my blessing, which is kind of what you sought when you called, even if this isn't something that I would want to engage in myself, or because it's so taboo and transgressive, and in a way for me triggering, not anything I'd want to hear about.
Hi, Dan. I have a question about polyamory and children. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and remember once, it was about a year ago, we were out with one of my partners, and she just says to a random stranger, "Oh, this is daddy's girlfriend, mummy's at home." And the woman wrinkled her nose and wandered off. So she kind of knows what's going on, but doesn't really. Obviously very, very careful to phrase things as friends and keep it very appropriate. But what advice you have about how you discuss these issues with little people.
There are adults out there, people in their 40s and 50s, even 60s, who were raised by lesbian parents. They were really the first wave of openly queer parents out there, women, lesbians, many of whom were raising children together that were from marriages, opposite sex marriages that they had entered into before they realized they were lesbians and came out. And a lot of these essays that I've read by people who are parented by lesbian couples in the 60s and 70s, talk about the burden of having to keep the secret because their parents couldn't be out. And so their parents shared a house, they were roommates, they were friends, but their parents weren't lovers and they certainly weren't spouses outside of the house. And the kids were told, you know, the truth about their mom's relationship, but then also sworn to secrecy so that they wouldn't lose custody, so that the kids themselves wouldn't be bullied or abused or stigmatized because of their mother's sexuality. And it was just an unavoidable fact of that era, the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, and in some places the right nows. But it was a burden for those kids. And it's hard to avoid the parallel here. You know, being out to your child about being in a polyamorous relationship places a burden on your child. You know, your child saw that woman wrinkle her nose up too, and felt judged and shamed in that moment in ways that she probably doesn't understand. And that's perilous for your child. And you have to balance then, you know, what you tell your child versus what you don't tell your child. And even that has risk. You know, if you have a girlfriend and mom's away and your child sees you interacting with your girlfriend in a way that's very clearly intimate, your child, even at 5, 7, 10, may think you're cheating on your spouse, on your wife, on her mother, with this other woman, and then feels just imperiled because if she tells mom or if mom finds out, then there's going to be a divorce, it's going to be ugly, and she has to keep this secret, help the cheating parent keep the secret to protect her own sense of security, to protect her own home. And that itself is a burden. Everywhere you turn, there's potentially a burden. And I feel really hypocritical, you know, unpacking this for you because Terry and I are parents. We have a 20-year-old son that we adopted at birth 20 years ago. Gay parents are more common now. Gay male couples parenting more common now, not as common then, not unheard of then, but not as common. And DJ was burdened by that in some respects. We couldn't be out about being a gay male couple. And so some of that burden fell to him. He was occasionally given grief by other kids. Thank God we live in a place like Seattle where it never rose to the level of bullying because of who his parents were, but some pushback, some grief he did get. And so I burdened him, we burdened him in a way that I'm advising you not to burden your own child with the fact about your polyamorous relationship. And that I recognize the hypocrisy there. I'm just trying to think about the best interests of your kid in this circumstance. And it sounds like at home you're out to your kid. But in the world, your kid being out or unselfconsciously conversational or blabby, as so many young kids are, about her family could result in more wrinkled noses, or worse, once your kid gets into grade school or high school. And I think that's the conversation you need to have with your kid. That this is the fact of who we are. A lot of people don't understand this. Kind of like in the 70s or the 60s, those lesbian moms had to have those kinds of conversations with their kids. People don't understand that this is good and healthy and that our love is good and that we are capable and fit parents. You understand it because we're your parents and we love you and you know you're loved and cared for. But outside of these four walls, you're going to have to say that we're roommates, not lovers or spouses because people don't understand. And I think that's the conversation you might have to have with your kid, that our relationship is good and loving and not dishonest and nobody's cheating, but a lot of people don't understand. Polyamory, people particularly don't understand or don't approve of polyamory when children are present. So you're going to have to be discreet. And that's a burden you'll be placing on your daughter's shoulders, but is less of a burden than her blindly going out into the world and telling truths about her family that then she encounters hostility, blowback, condemnation, bullying, as a result of not being braced for that. 5 seems a little young to have that conversation, but certainly 6 or 7 isn't too young to have that conversation. Going into 1st grade, not too young to have that conversation. This is who we are. This is your family. A lot of people out there don't approve and don't understand. And we're working on that. More people who are poly are coming out, telling their truths. It's going to change. It's going to get better. Just as things have changed for same-sex couples raising kids. But it's going to take time. And in the meantime, you're going to have to think carefully about who you can trust, really trust, when you talk openly about your family. For my busy listeners, when it comes to dinner, skip meal planning and shopping and get straight to the cooking with Blue Apron. You'll enjoy delicious meals like crispy chicken tenders and mashed potatoes, or pasta and creamy tomato sauce on the table in as little as 20 minutes. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you feast on a meal you made yourself. And if, like me and Tara, you're trying to eat a little less meat these days, Blue Apron's delicious vegetarian options are a great way to do that. You choose chef-designed recipes, they deliver fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients, and suddenly, you're a good cook. Blue Apron offers 3 plans, a 2-person meal plan, a family plan, and a wine plan. We go with the family plan, so there's always delicious leftovers in the fridge. Blue Apron is offering our listeners 3 free meals to try it out. Again, I'm going to say it, Terry and I are Blue Apron customers. We use it regularly, and we love it, and we want you to try it. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free at blueapron.com/savage. That's blueapron.com/savage to get your first 3 meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm a straight cis male. I've been with my wife. Well, I call her my wife. We've been together about 11 years. We've never really been married. We were engaged. We lived together. We got together right out of high school. We're both 29 now. We've always had a great relationship, good sex life and everything like that. Throughout the years, we've always kind of had the conversation of having an open relationship. And we've always been kind of open-minded about that and always wanted to be communicative with each other regarding the subject. But it's never really come up. We're both generally happy enough in our relationship that we don't actively pursue other partners. But recently, a girl that I kind of have a crush on, she just kind of gave me her number out of the blue, and that took me for a loop a little bit. And I spoke with my, I still call her my wife. I spoke with her about it. I kind of set up a date with this girl. My wife was fine with it. We went out on a date, or I went out on a date with this girl, and it was a good time, and I enjoyed it. Continued to have communication with my wife afterwards about what was going on. But it's seeming like she's maybe a little uncomfortable with it. And I know it's kind of natural to have feelings of jealousy and things like that when an open relationship starts to open up like that. But I just want to make sure I'm not taking this too far. We didn't do anything. I haven't had sex with this new girl or anything, but she's also kind of feeling jealous just because she hasn't been asked on a date and I have. And I just want to make sure that I approach this properly. I enjoyed the date. I'd like to pursue it more and maybe pursue a sexual relationship with this person, but I just don't want to ruin what's going on with my wife. So just any tips I can receive regarding how to approach the situation, I would appreciate it.
I want to parse one thing you said before I give you some tips. You say that you've talked over the 11 years that you've been together with your common-law wife about opening the relationship potentially at some point, but we are, quote, both happy right now, so you haven't actively pursued others. That's a dangerous way, if you're interested in ever opening your relationship, of framing opening up the relationship. At a point where we are unhappy, we will open the relationship. That's what you're saying. And you don't want opening up the relationship to mean that. You don't want opening up or having an experience with somebody else to symbolize there's a flaw in our relationship, or our relationship is collapsing, or we are both miserable and our needs aren't being met. So I'd encourage you to drop that kind of rhetoric. And I don't think it's what you meant, but words have power. And when we say something and when we frame something a certain way, it can come to mean that. We can experience it in that way. And it's possible your wife is experiencing it in this way. If you both discussed opening the relationship over the last 11 years as something that you'll do someday, maybe in the future, when you're not happy with each other, your wife is highly likely to be reading into this date, you are not happy with her. There's some problem in your primary relationship. And so you need to touch base with the wife about that. And you need to drop that kind of rhetorical framing of opening up your relationship. It should come from a place of abundance and joy. Sometimes in a relationship, there is a need that can't be met. And a relationship will open for that reason. But that's not about unhappiness. That's just about a fact. Some couples open up because one partner is bi and they want to have a same-sex experience that their other partner cannot provide for them. It's not about unhappiness. It's just about impossibility. Anyway, I shall cease parsing. Yeah, it's tricky when you first open up a relationship and you need to check in with your long-term partner again and again and again to make sure that they are comfortable. It may not be possible to get her to a place where she is completely 100% comfortable with this. In a way, you are bungee jumping, both of you together, even though you're the one who may be having this experience with somebody else. Your relationship, singular, is bungee jumping off a bridge. And that's scary. It is a scary step. And people have fears. And sometimes those fears can only be addressed or resolved after the relationship is open. Like, what will this mean? Will it change how we feel about each other? Will it imperil our relationship? Will it pull us away from each other or bring us closer? Well, those are questions that can only be answered after the relationship is opened. So it's fucking scary. And your wife is legitimately scared. And you need to speak with her. And one way to make her more comfortable is to let her be in charge, that she has absolute control here. And one way to make her more comfortable is to make sure that she knows you're not going to do this without her okay. And you may get that okay without her being 100% comfortable, but you're not going to do it without her buy-in. So you won't pursue this woman or any other woman without her permission. And she can pull the brakes if and when she feels she needs to. And you're going to give her that power because your relationship with her is your first priority. As for the issue of her feeling uncomfortable because you have been pursued now by this other woman and she hasn't been pursued by any other men, that's easily resolved. All she has to do is put herself on Tinder or put herself out there or go out with her girlfriends alone. And men being men, she will be pursued. The question we most often get from opposite sex couples opening up their relationship is she's swimming in dick and he can't find any pussy. So the dick is out there, and the guys who would be interested in seeing her are out there, and men are more open, it seems, to dating a woman in a relationship than women are open to dating a man in a relationship. So if it's just about evening the scales, it's just about if you're going out on a date with somebody else, I want to go on a date with somebody else too, you guys can make that happen. And the internet is here to help you make that happen. One last note, this woman who approached you and gave you her number and you went out on a date with that woman, does she know that you have a person you call your wife at home? Does she know that you are in a committed relationship and you're only interested in sex perhaps on the side right now with others? If she didn't know it by the end of the first date, you need to tell her by at least the end of the third date and before you have any sexual contact with her at all. She has a right to know. Summer is nearly over. Time to commit to an exercise workout routine that you can stick to keep fit. That's why I highly approve of Aptiv. Aptiv offers expert trainers for the best results and motivation, a flexible audio workout format so you can work out the way you like, and a variety of classes and levels to keep you engaged. Personal trainers are great, but personal trainers are really expensive. They're also conspicuous. Not everyone is comfortable at the gym drawing attention to themselves. That makes Aptiv a great option. Whenever, wherever you like to work out, at the gym, home, outside, when you're traveling for business, Aptiv is ready to go along with you with their mobile app. It's like having a personal trainer in your pocket and on call 24 hours a day. Aptiv's in-house music production team partners with every trainer to create music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your workout. When you need that extra boost, the music kicks in to keep you going and keep you motivated. And when you're ready to slow things down, the intensity of the music dials down with you. They have 5K, 10K, half, and full marathon training programs and a supportive community full of Aptiv members of all levels reaching for their fitness goals just like you. Aptiv is such a cool and effective way to keep committed to working out. Subscriptions start at $14.99 billed monthly or $99.99 for an annual membership. For a limited time, new members get 30% off an annual membership, which is just $69.99 for the whole year of unlimited workouts. Visit aptive.com/savage, and thank you for doing that because it helps us here at the Savage Lovecast if you do. That's aptive.com/savage.
Hey, Dan. I'm calling with a more family-oriented advice question. My mom is in her early 60s, and she's been an avid smoker. She's at least been smoking a pack a day for the last 15 years and has smoked long before that. And at the beginning of this year, she started developing a cough. And my brother, sister, and I all separately told her that we were concerned and that she should go seek medical help. And it's been months and she still hasn't. And we keep dropping hints, like I've been sending her podcasts about, you know, certain types of neuroscience and also certain types of drugs that could help stop her from smoking, that she could talk to her doctor about when she goes to the doctor. My sister printed out a huge list of doctors that met my mom's really, you know, meticulous requirements. And yet my mom hasn't done anything and her coughing is still there. And I'm just really worried that it's going to be too late when she goes to the doctor. She's comes from a long lineage of health problems. Her mother and father both died early of cancer and a heart attack. And I'm just really worried that she's going to meet the same fate continuing with the lifestyle that she is. And I'm not sure if it's procrastination or anxiety, but I just don't know why she's not going to get help. And we really aren't the kind of family that really confronts each other like this. And I hate to feel in my heart that it's so hard for me to talk to her about this, but it just, it's almost as if I'm already mourning her because I know that she's not well and she's not taking the steps to make herself better, you know? And I'm just wondering if you have advice for me, my brother, my sister about how we can go about getting her to the goddamn doctor.
You can't make an adult woman who hasn't been declared incompetent and made your ward go to the doctor. You can only importune your mother to go to the doctor. This calls for an intervention. Get your siblings together, go see mom, and plead with her, and ask her if there's anything that's preventing her from getting her ass to the doctor that you guys can help with. Is it that she doesn't have transportation? Has she not seen a primary care physician in a million years and doesn't even know where to start or how one goes about getting a doctor's appointment? Ask her those things, see what she says. But if in the end she declines to seek treatment for what may be a very serious problem, there's literally nothing you can do about that, short of going to court and having your mother declared incompetent and gaining power of attorney over her and compelling her to seek treatment. I want to say people have a right to seek or not seek medical care. We live in the United States of America, at least I do, and many of my listeners do, and we do not have a right here to seek medical care, but we have a right to decline it. And if your mother wants to enjoy the last couple of years of her life in declining health with her old friend cigarettes instead of in an oncology ward seeking treatment and having the cigarettes pried from her hands, that's her choice. And in the end, if the choice is rational and your mother isn't suffering from dementia, you have to let her make her own choices, as stressful or as painful as that can be to watch. Here at the Savage Lovecast, we want your bed to be inviting and sexy and comfortable. That's why you should get some beautiful new sheets from Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of $100. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. Boll & Branch only uses sustainable and responsible methods of sourcing and manufacturing. They also donate a portion of every sale to charity to help fight human trafficking while preserving fair prices for consumers. And new sheets are arguably the best gift imaginable, right? Make them purr like a kitten. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights if you don't love them, and I'm sure that you will, but if you don't, you can send them back for a refund. But you're not going to want to send them back. Still, there's no risk and no reason then not to give Bowl and Branch a try. To get you started right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com when you use the promo code SAVAGE. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code SAVAGE. bowlandbranch.com, promo code SAVAGE.
Hi, Dan. I am in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. I just listened to the first episode of your podcast. My sister introduced me when we were talking about my current relationship. I am not experienced in relationships. I'm 30 years old, but I was raised in an ultra-Orthodox cult family, and so talking to women wasn't allowed. I went through many years of sexual confusion, still going through it. My issue now is that I am dating an 18-year-old. She is from a non-religious converted family, but she is semi-religious. She was going to go away for a year of school in a religious school on the East Coast that I know sort of tries to make people more religious than they are. It would be a year away from her. In general, I'm confused about the relationship due to the age gap. I'm 30, she's 18. But she's very mature. Her ethnicity is not American, so she's got, you know, a real maturity about her that's sort of different. But I don't know what to do. I don't know if I should stick with this relationship throughout the year and wait, if I should see other people. I feel like I'm just sort of blooming and being comfortable getting close to people and having an intimate relationship. So maybe, you know, I should let this go and see other people. She doesn't want me to do that, but also would understand if that happened. I know she has some growing up to do, so her going away seems like it would be good. I'm just extremely confused. I seem to care about her more every time she tells me she's going away. And then when she said she wasn't going away for the year, I seem to care about her a little bit less, so it's a little bit confusing. In general, 30, 18 is more what I'm concerned about. I don't know if I'm crazy or if I'm taking advantage of something or if I'm weak. It doesn't feel like that, but it's sort of the judgments I get from other people. The reason this is my first relationship at 30 years old is because I spent pretty much the last 10 years being in love with someone in an unrequited love situation, and it was a boy. I have thought I was gay for a long time. This is my first time sort of really dealing with my emotional issues, which may have contributed to my sexual confusion. I notice people start their conversations going, you know, I'm X, Y, and Z old, and I am straight, or I am lesbian. I have no idea what I am, but I think I love her, and it's confusing because it's hard to tell which part of my confusion is due to my sexual orientation versus due to the abuse I endured as a kid versus due to the religious abuse versus due to, you know, just the age gap. Is it ever okay for a 30-year-old to be in love with an 18-year-old?
Is it ever okay for a 30-year-old to be in love with an 18-year-old? Sure. 30-year-old is an adult, an 18-year-old is an adult. There are people out there in loving, committed, healthy relationships where there is a 12-year age gap, and some of those people met when one of them was 18 and the other of them was 30. There are people in college at 18, freshmen in college, who wound up meeting and clicking with and dating a grad student or a PhD student who is a decade older. And there have been wonderful short-term relationships that came of those sorts of meetings and wonderful long-term relationships that came of those meetings. But that's not the question to ask. The question isn't, is it ever okay for a 30-year-old to be in love with an 18-year-old? The question is this the right thing for you to do? Are you in a place in your life, in your development, where you are mature enough to be in a relationship at all, much less a relationship that faces the challenges that this relationship faces, including the long distance thing and all of the religious agitas, all the religious bullshit, all the hangups, all the shame and the stigma that you're both wrestling with, and that she seems to be heading off to college to reinforce and make worse if she's going to some bananas Christian college. Maybe at the insistence of her family, where they try to make people who are already religious a little, I want to say worse, but there are a lot of religious people out there who listen to this show who aren't terrible and aren't bad. And for some people, religion is a lovely and positive force in their lives. And I want to acknowledge that, but still. it's not her or no one. It sounds like you have other options. It sounds like there are other people in your orbit that you've considered dating or are open to dating and are open to dating you. And I would encourage you to say to her, look, neither of us are at a point in our lives where we're ready to commit or ready for anything serious. And so I want you to go off to college and I'm going to do my thing and we're both going to mature and learn and grow. And then we'll see. Maybe dating at 13 and 18, us right now, isn't ideal. Who knows when I'm 35 and you're 23 or I'm 40 and you're 28, maybe then would be the right time. Or maybe we'll be with other people at that time, but we'll still always remember each other fondly and maybe be able to remain in touch and play a role in each other's lives, even if it isn't the, you know, starring role in each other's lives. And then go figure your shit out, dude. You say that you maybe are confused about your sexual orientation. Whenever anyone says that to me, I look at them and I say, what do you masturbate about? And I can see it in their faces that they know exactly who they are sexually when you put it that way. When you stop filtering desire through expectation, through what your family wanted for you or wants for you or what your imaginary sky friend wants for you or you were told your imaginary sky friend or friends wants for you by your family. What are you masturbating about? When you lay in bed in the middle of the night and you're going to crank one out, you're going to have a wank, what unspools in the theater of your mind? Is it dudes? Maybe you're gay. Definitely you're gay. If it's only dudes. Is it women too? Is it women sometimes? Well, maybe you're bi. If it's women only, maybe you're straight. Or definitely you're straight. And I'm not saying or suggesting that because you had this 10-year unrequited crush on a man that you have to be bi or gay. Sometimes, you know, in intense situations, we're under a lot of pressure from our families. We take our romantic desires and we set them aside. We put them in a place where they cannot be fulfilled. And we have a crush on an inanimate object, a mythical beast, someone we're not capable of loving intimately, romantically, sexually. But we pour all of our sort of emotional, romantic impulses into that person for safekeeping. Like you see that often in young women who have crushes on their best friends because, and they're not bi and they're not lesbians, because it's safer than having a crush on a testosterone-soaked dick monster teenage boy. And that can lead to some confusion, that kind of romantic attachment, romantic friendship, or a friendship that's taken on a romantic sort of dimension, tone. It's allowing you to experience in a safe way something that may be too dangerous to experience in reality. So you just put it all aside or put it in a box. But at the end of the day, dude, you're still reeling from the religious indoctrination, that religious abuse that you suffered, from the abuse that you suffered, from this sexual confusion. You're not in a place, you're not mature enough. You don't know yourself well enough. You're not in good working order. You can't commit to this girl. This 18-year-old girl. You couldn't commit to her if she was 28. You couldn't commit to her if she was 30, if she was 38. You're not in a place. The age difference is not the issue here. The issue here is you, the condition you're in. You don't know yourself well enough to give yourself to someone else, to commit to someone else. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to let her go off to college. You're going to break the fuck up. Not out of bitterness or anger. There's no dumping the motherfucker already here because no one's a motherfucker. You just met someone that you clicked with and you need to acknowledge that neither of you are in a place right now in your lives where you could pursue something more serious. And so it's over. That doesn't mean it can't pick up again in the future. And that doesn't mean in the future you won't meet somebody else that you feel as strongly about as you feel right now about her. Sounds like you may have taken refuge in this romantic relationship with the dude for 10 years. Don't make the mistake of turning around now at 30, now that you've partially climbed out from under the mound of bullshit that was heaped up on you by your family, and invest prematurely in this girl and put it all there instead. Pull way the fuck back, be with yourself, be single, date, and get to know yourself. And finally, I'm going to ask you one more time, what do you think about when you jack off?
Hey, Dan. So my girlfriend and I have a decent age gap between us. Now, we've known each other for a while, about 4 years, and have been together for 1 year now. We both share the same ideal when it comes to not having children. We do, however, both receive some nagging about this from time to time. Of course, some people hold the mentality that heterosexuality calls for a certain lifestyle of getting married, having children, settle down, and work yourself to death. Frankly, it's bullshit. Of course, every sexuality runs into their own version of this. My question would be, do you have any suggestions for us and anyone else really in this situation on how to cope with it or even to handle it with both like family and even like outside sources?
I'm trying to empathize, but I'm actually having a little difficulty empathizing at this moment. And you even acknowledge that there are people out there, other sexual orientations, who encounter worse. I'm one of those people who encountered worse. You're a straight couple. People look at you and they ask, when are you having kids? Which is a shitty thing to say. People shouldn't ask that of straight couples or any couples. There are couples out there who are struggling and have been struggling for years to have kids and then to have family that they're not close to, that they're not sharing their struggle with, approach them at an event, a barbecue, a birthday party, a christening, a baby shower, and say, hey, why haven't you two had kids yet? That can just really shred someone emotionally who's been struggling and trying for years to have kids. So just as a general rule, folks, everybody listening, please know, don't ask people when they're having kids, because you don't know whether they're trying and having a hard time and just in so much pain about it, or whether they don't want them. It's none of your fucking business. All that said, caller, what do you do? How do you cope? You just shut it down. You just say, you've only been together a year and people are asking you this now, and they just need, the people who are asking you just need to hear from you more than once. We're not having kids. Neither of us want to have kids. We've decided together. One of the things that makes us a good pair and one of the reasons we are together is that neither of us want this. And you asking isn't going to fertilize her eggs or change our minds. So stop fucking asking. You can just push back hard. And I don't want to, you know, what about this? And I don't want to play oppression Olympics with you. But the shit that was said to and about me and Terry when we were about to have a kid, when we were going to have a child, when we were adopting, it wasn't, when are you going to have kids? It was, why are you having kids? And from some quarters, it was, oh, we know why you're having kids. You're adopting because you want to rape children. I think that's a little worse. That felt a little worse, especially when my kid was old enough to hear people say that about why we adopted, which happened. So yeah, for gay couples, for a lot of us, this script is flipped. Not when are you going to have children, but how dare you, or why, or I know why you want to have children, and it's for a nefarious purpose. And that sucks. And what's happening to you sucks too. We're not playing oppression Olympics. We're not going to attach a value or weight to this. But we all have our crosses to bear when it comes to assholes saying rude things or asking impertinent questions about our choices around when and whether to parent. And you should do, caller and other people, what we did when we encountered assholes asking or insinuating assholy things about our decision to parent or not to parent. Shut them the fuck down.
Hi, I have a comment for one of the callers from episode 620, the guy who was sending question mark messages on Grindr to the guy that wasn't responding to him. I thought that Dan's advice was spot on with the, like, this guy isn't into you, he's wasting your time, move on. I just wanted to add that also, I don't think that it's a good idea to send guys the question mark message, even if they were interested in you. I've had guys where we're talking and I get busy and at work or just whatever with life and don't message for a while, and then they send me this blank question mark message, and I lose interest. I just, like, if they can't handle like a little gap in conversation, then I don't know that I want to hang out with them. I think it's a lot better to send a message that starts conversation again, like, hey, how was the rest of your day? Or, you know, what's up? It's Wednesday, rather than this like passive aggressive, like, you didn't answer my last message.
Hey, what's going on, Dan? I'm calling about episode 620 and the woman who called in whose husband keeps initiating foreplay and then kind of stopping in the middle and not having sex and leaving her very frustrated. One of the things that I think you might have overlooked when you were responding is this guy might be impotent or have some sort of ED that kind of kicks in because he's initiating, he's starting foreplay. His dick might not be getting hard, and rather than letting her realize that, he's just stopping altogether because he'd rather just stop than realize that he's not getting hard while he's initiating sex. Obviously, there's a lot of details she kind of left out that you can't answer that for sure, but it's something to consider.
Hey, Dan, this is a call about the guy in episode 620 who was cranking up his girlfriend and then telling her he wanted to go to bed. I don't disagree that he's an asshole and should knock this shit off, but I think it's coming from a kinky place instead of him trying to create conflict. My guess is he's trying to get her to beg for sex. Still asshole behavior, and he should knock that shit off, but yep, that's my take.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you want to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Tickets are on sale now for the 14th annual Hump Film Festival. The deadline for submission just passed. We have more submissions this year than to any other hump before, which means the 14th annual hump is going to be amazing. You can get your tickets for the premiere of the 14th annual Hump in San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, and Olympia right now at humpfilmfest.com. Follow me on Twitter at @FakeDanSavage. Follow JP Bramer on Twitter at @JPBramer. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech savvy at risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.